Welcome to the Trombone Retreat, podcast of the Third Coast Trombone Retreat. Today on the podcast, we're welcoming the legends of the trombone recording industry, Bill Reichenbach and Alan Kaplan. We're very excited. My name is Sebastian Vera. This is my friend Nick Schwartz.
Hello.
So we are live at the 52nd International Trombone Festival in Salt Lake City, Utah, on the campus of the University of Utah. So this is a live recording. So feel free to laugh, to clap, whatever. But just a few things. If you don't know who we are, we're a couple friends that started a trombone festival 10 years ago on the 12th drink at a bar. That's what we say. We add a beer every time we tell the story, so it's quite a few now. We ended up creating a podcast during the pandemic, and you know it started as a pandemic project, and it became really fun, and now it's been listened to in 111 countries, and we put out 41 episodes. So subscribe to the Trombone Retreat everywhere you find your podcasts. We quickly just want to thank Houghton Horns, which is our main sponsor. Houghton Horns spreads the joy of music through providing the highest level of products, services, and resources to the brass playing community. They wish they could have been here at the festival, but they're moving into a new facility in Texas, and they're really proud to support the podcast. And we encourage you to check them out online at houghtonhorns.com and in person at their facility in Keller, Texas. Houghton Horns First Class Brass. Okay, shall we get to it?
Let's do it.
Okay, we are honored to invite Bill Reichenbach and Alan Kaplan, who probably are maybe the most heard trombonist in the world. You probably can't think of one movie that you haven't heard them on, or a TV show. And we'll try to get to everything they've been on. But one thing before I introduce them. So if you get your Whova app out, there's a chance to ask questions. So if you're interested in asking any questions, we're going to try to get to some at the end, and I can access it here on my phone. So if there's anything that comes up during the interview that you're curious about, feel free, and I'll try to get to as many as I can. All right. Without further ado, Alan Kaplan and Bill Reichenbach. Mic should be on.
Test.
Okay. Yeah, it's not going to sound loud, but right. It's okay. Recording.
Did you say a live recording? I'm nervous.
No, yeah. It's well, it's not. It's live here, but we'll edit stuff later.
Okay.
So we're used to that too.
Yeah, we're used to that. It'll be okay.
So cuss as much as you want. You know.
Oh.
They love that in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, so. Of course.
It's really fine here. How you guys doing?
Great.
What are you excited about seeing here?
Oh, lots of mouthpieces.
Yeah. So this is actually not the first time I've been able to ask you questions. I don't think you'll remember this, but you did like a 10-question series on... Do you remember the Online Trombone Journal?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So you did like a Online Trombone Journal series. And yeah, feel free to come in. And... It was like 10 questions with Bill Reichenbach, and you could submit a question. And I believe I was like 15 or 16, and I submitted a question. It was the first one chosen. And wow. I wrote like, I want to be, you know, a studio trombonist someday and basically do everything you do. What advice would you have for me? And the first thing you said was, well, get ready to not eat for a while.
That's sort of a shorthand for, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's probably probably true. It's probably still true. Yeah.
But then you gave a lot of thoughtful advice about have a knowledge of every type of style of playing, and
that helps. Yeah. Well, first of all, you want to move to the right town. If you want to play in the studios, you have to move to a town that has studio business. You know, so that limits it right there. It's New York, L.A., maybe Chicago, maybe Nashville, a little bit maybe in Miami. I'm not sure what... I mean, there could be local recording almost anywhere, probably, but it wouldn't necessarily be enough to make a living. So the main towns are those. And you got to get there, and you have to be patient. You have to meet other players and play with them and make a good impression on them. Don't noodle too much.
Yeah, so what's your advice? I mean, just kind of diving right into that, what's your advice on cold calling, getting in touch with people in the scene, you know, like if someone wants to meet one of you, obviously they would want to if they want to break into the studio scene, right? What's advice for doing that process?
Well, I think I don't mind if people reach out when they say, can you help me get into a gig? Well, that's different, because when we recommend people, it's our reputation on the line.
Sure.
So I really have to know everything about a player before I recommend, but I'm happy to get to know them and steer them in whatever direction in terms of who they can maybe take lessons with, who they can rehearse with if there's rehearsals. That's a really good way to get heard by people. And the other thing is, it's also education, because these guys come in and they're not going to know everything there is that's going to be thrown at them. And some of these rehearsals may open their eyes a little bit about what they need to learn. But I'm always, happy to hear from people. And a lot of times, nowadays I do a lot in just writing. A lot of people will submit questions and I'll answer them without actually meeting face to face.
Cool. We'll have a lot of questions for you today, so that works out perfectly. So just can I get just like a brief background of the two of you? So, and then we can get to the point where you guys finally met and started working together. So, Bill, you grew up outside D.C.,
mm-hmm.
Tacoma Park. And your dad was a
jazz drummer.
Prominent jazz drummer.
Yeah. Yeah, he played with a guitarist named Charlie Byrd. Well, I was born in 1949, and around that time, my parents were both traveling on the road with the Tommy Dorsey Band. So I was probably hearing some trombone from within.
Did you ever share any stories about being around Tommy Dorsey?
Yeah. He wasn't a very nice guy.
Really? Yeah. Really? Whoa. That's shocking, actually.
Well,
I've heard that,
are
too.
Are you kidding?
No, no. Oh, no. I really
oh, no. He nice wasn't guy? A very nice guy. I figured everybody knew that.
Yeah. It's okay. He doesn't listen to the podcast.
I mean,
so.
Buddy Rich. No, not anymore. Yeah. Buddy Rich styled himself after Tommy Dorsey.
Okay, that's enough said.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's pretty much established, and Benny Goodman was another one that wasn't a very well-liked person.
Let's just talk about everyone that was mean this whole
thing. Oh, yeah, no. I think
that'd be fun.
We'll go long into the afternoon if we have to.
Yeah. So who do you hate?
So the moral of the story is, if you want to run like a 1940s swing band, you got to be kind of an asshole.
Not anymore. No, I'm kind of playing in one of them in Nashville, and it's the guy that runs it is nice. So it's
awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's good.
So how did you first come to the trombone, both of you?
I was it appealed to my sense of humor, I think, actually. I mean, I heard Dixieland records a little bit, and I liked what the trombone did. And I thought that was, it had a sort of a humorous vibe to it. And I had been playing drums since I was about five. My father had the drums were at the house, you know, so you just kind of started playing them because they were there. But when I was coming up to my 11th birthday, he said, well, I'll get you a camera or a trombone. I said, I'll take the trombone. And that's how it started.
So you're like, what can be more loud than playing the drums all the time? I'll just switch to bass trombone.
Well, I showed him. Yeah.
And Alan, are you a lifetime in L.A.? You grew up in L.A.?
Yeah, I grew up in L.A. And it was hearing the school band. I mean, I had a neighbor who played steel guitar, and I thought that looked interesting. But when I saw the band, I realized there's no steel guitar in the band. I had to pick an instrument. So when I was 8 years old, I chose the trombone just because it looked like fun. I didn't have any musicians in my family, so I didn't have any background
eight
whatsoever. It just looked like fun.
That's young, eight.
Yeah. You would think I'd be better by now.
And you were studying engineering for a while, right?
Like, yeah, I never thought. Being that there were no musicians in my family, everyone says, oh, you can't make it as a musician. So I had that going on in my head the whole time. And it was math major. And it wasn't when I got to college. I went to a college that had a really great band. And a lot of guys were working professionally already with Don Ellis and some of the other local bands. But I was an engineering major, and I switched to music after the first semester. I said, oh, I've got to do music. I just have to. And it started with education major, and I, you know, thinking, well, I'll fall back. But basically, that's the limit of my education, because after 2 years, I got called to go with Buddy Rich when I was 19. So I didn't have to worry about a degree.
How did that come about, the relationship with Buddy Rich?
Well, for me, it was because his lead trumpet player, John Madrid, had come back off the road and was playing at another college band. I played in three different college bands because they all rehearsed at different days. So L.A. City College is where he came back to rehearse. So I'm playing with him. And they asked him if he knew of a trombone player out in L.A. because they were coming to do 2 weeks at Disneyland. So they figured it would be a good time to get somebody. So I didn't join the band, so I was recommended by John. And I didn't join the band, as you remember, I joined in Chicago. You guys did a gig at the Airy Crown, and I replaced Bruce Paulson. And he handed me the two uniforms and the book and said, good luck. And then there were three gigs, and then we were in L.A. for 2 weeks.
Wow.
So that was my start.
Well, I mean, there's a famous tape online of him on the Buddy Rich on the bus chewing out, you know, I think it starts with the saxes and then it kind of bleeds into everybody else. Number one, were you there for that? I mean, I guess maybe there were multiple.
There were
multiple versions.
Yeah, and okay. those were later. Those were I think in the early 80s. What you're talking
that
about?
That was one of his hits. he would perform that for every new band.
Oh, know? That's good.
Yeah.
I'm sure it felt really nice.
Yeah,
well, felt great.
We had, I think we had Rand sessions once a week, right, on the average?
Well, he had one about 3 days after I got on the band. Yeah.
And at this point, you're on the road with him, kind of stuck a little
bit,
right?
Yeah, like, oh, my God, let me off this bus. Yeah,
like, and as a 19-year-old, I mean, that's were you old enough to even realize how nervous you should be?
Oh, I was so nervous. And fortunately, I'd been sight reading so much that when I did the first gig, and there's no rehearsal, it's just do the gig, I got through without making any mistakes, but Buddy had to say something to me. So he got up from the drums. My trombone stand was next to me. He said, hey, kid, move that trombone stand. So that was, you know, no compliment. That was just,
yeah.
That was it.
He acknowledged your presence.
Yes.
Yeah. He spoke to me.
Yeah.
He knows my name, Kid.
Kid.
And were you joining around the same time?
No, I was already on. Yeah.
Okay. And that was after Eastman?
Yeah. Yeah. It was if I had been really a grad major, it would have been during that year.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And you were, it was with Remington when you were there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
Oh, that was fantastic. Yeah. It was, it was as close to being a religious experience as I can imagine. I studied with one of his students, Bob Isley, through high school. And Bob had studied with Remington for 1 year, like 1939 or something like that, before he went into the Marine Band as the soloist. And so, you know, hearing Bob for the first time, when the first notes he played in my lesson was another one of those experiences where I'd never heard a sound like that before, you know. And so I studied with him through high school, and then I sort of haphazardly decided that I was going to audition at Eastman when a friend of my father's, a piano player who had gone to Eastman, said, yeah, your son is about ready to go to college. He should go to Eastman. You know, and I'm kind of like, duh. And so they made a phone call and got me an audition. And I flew up there and auditioned. And that was once I played for Remington, he sang with me on my audition. And I played various things, and there was one piece that he didn't know, some French piece, I don't remember what it was. He wouldn't even let me play it. He wanted to, you know, we did a little Bach and a little Rochu, and he sang those. I figured, this guy can't even hear me. So it made me so relaxed, you know.
He was known to sing, right?
Oh, he sang all the time.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Through all the lessons, he sang every lesson. Yeah, like 8 students a day, 5 days a week.
Wow, so he had a worked-up voice.
Oh, he could do it, yeah.
So what was your big... Was Buddy Rich the first kind of touring ensemble that you experienced?
That was my only touring ensemble. That kind of made up my mind that I didn't want to do
that. I'm guessing you had opportunities to do so.
Well,
past that.
I could have gone on Maynard's band. around that time, and it just didn't feel like something I wanted to do.
Was it the experience of being on the road, like just hotel to hotel?
The hotels, yeah. On those kind of gigs, you're not staying in the Grand Lux hotels.
Was it like have a roommate sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. We were roommates a lot.
Can I tell them about the ghosting?
Please.
Oh, yeah. The ghosting. Ooh.
We used to do what's called ghosting because...
Is that the same definition of what ghosting is now?
I'm not sure. No, it's not.
It depends on...
What we called ghosting was... Because we didn't make that much money. My starting salary was $225 a week, and we're paying our own room and board. So we would get a single room. It was probably $7, $8 a night, but only one guy would check in. And the other guy, I was usually one not registered because he was getting calls from his girlfriend. So he registered, and then I would just show up. And there was usually a second bed, so I'd sleep in the second bed. Sometimes we took the mattress and threw it on the floor. So they didn't have a record of me checking in for the first 6 months I'm on the band. So, but we were splitting the rent. Now it's only $4 a night.
Yeah.
That was the
or
ghosting.
Less.
Or less, yeah.
Yeah.
That was the ghosting then.
Wow.
Yeah.
clever way to save some money, huh?
You did.
You had to.
You still could hardly save any money. You know, they were paying around 2.25 taking taxes out.
And then you had
and
to
And you're paying all your own
board.
Expenses.
Yeah.
So at the end of, at the end of 7 months, I think I'd saved $25 or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And just to go back to going on the road, and would it have been a similar situation with Maynard's band?
Probably.
Yeah. So yeah. You really...
That's what the bands paid back then.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
You're playing your ass off and not getting paid really, yeah.
Well, that still happens.
Not just to
any music. Most musicians.
True.
Well, the dollar to note quotient.
Yeah.
Is still the same. You get the most dollars for the least notes, and then you can do some of these gigs that you just never stop playing, and it's for not much money.
Have you had some sessions where you get there and the music's on the stand and it's like five notes?
Oh God, yes.
Oh, most of the time.
We've sat through dates tacit for a lot, where we're not even playing. Or a lot of times for some of the things we could do, we have some nice soft whole notes here and there. So it's like, this isn't very good. If students saw this, they think, I can do student work. I can do all that stuff.
But you see five notes and you miss one and you're like, damn it.
Well, then you really feel like an idiot. Yeah.
Well, that's a high percentage of missing. I missed 20% of the notes. One out of five.
Hey, that's still an 80%. It's a B plus, B minus.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember meeting for the first time?
It was exactly in Chicago
on Buddy's band
in June of 1972.
Do you remember your first impressions of each other?
I think you asked me if I want to be a roommate when I first
probably,
met you.
I think probably, because I wanted to save some money.
Yeah,
He seems all right.
And you were I was the youngest guy on the band, and then you were the youngest.
Yeah.
Oh.
So.
Took your spot.
Seemed like. And I, there was a whole lot of other guys in the band that I would have never wanted to room with. I hardly wanted to go on the bandstand with them, actually. So that would have been difficult.
I'm learning this for the first time.
So, researching this and researching y'all's careers, it's really mind blowing. Trying to figure out where to start is who knows. And a lot of these recordings you've gotten to do together. But if I can brag on you guys for just a little bit and for our listeners that may not know of what you have played, and obviously I can't list everything, but I'll start with Alan, and I assume a lot of these you're on as well. But let's see, 1100 films, Animal House, Airplane, Dances with Wolves, Out of Africa, Sleepless in Seattle, Beauty and the Beast, Hercules, Lion King, Con Air, Batman Robin, Zorro, Planet of the Apes, Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3, Men in Black, Pirates of the Caribbean 1, 2, and 3. The Incredibles, which is such a badass recording. Star Wars Rogue One, Coco, Frozen, Frozen 2, Greatest Showman. I can keep going. So where do you want to start? Because
So we talked about being on the road, and then so who left the band first, and was it straight to L.A.? You left the band first, Bill. Okay.
And, yeah. Then I went back to Washington, D.C. for a while and did some and worked back there a lot. And then I moved to L.A. in 1975.
What was the impetus for moving to L.A.? Just
oh, I always wanted to do something like I wanted to do studio work. That was my goal.
Okay.
And I figured that between New York and L.A., those were the two choices. And if I ended up having to sleep on the street, L.A. would be more comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. There's quite a few people who found that to be true.
Yeah. you can't beat that logic, right? And I did this. I wanted to be a studio player as well. I was studying with studio players all along, and then when I went on the road, that was my ultimate goal. But I had my initial dream was to play with Buddy Rich's band of all bands. That was my favorite. And what I did after I left, but he left first, and then 6 months later I left, and I had gotten a call to go with Harry James's band right at the time, and I didn't know what was going on, but our itinerary was getting kind of sketchy, and I thought, and the band wasn't as good. And I said, can I think about it? Because I might want to make the change. And that night, I show up on the gig, and we get our 2 weeks' notice from Buddy.
Wow.
Because he had decided to open a club in New York and work with a small group.
Wow. Oh, that's serendipitous.
Oh, yeah. It was unbelievable. So I call him back, said, yeah, I think I'm going to do it, but I need a little bit more money. So I got a little more money out of him.
Oh.
And then I went with Harry James. And I had only, it was, like you say, serendipitous. I had like a week off in between.
Wow.
So
is that your last week off that you've had?
No.
So can you guys, do you think you could trace a single like first like foot in the door, big break to like start getting to record so consistently?
Yeah. Well, when I went out to L.A., shortly after I moved out there, a friend of mine, a trumpet player, moved out there named Jerry Hay. He was in a band called Sea Wind. They were in Hawaii, and they moved to L.A. And Jerry was and is a great arranger, a great trumpet player. He's not playing anymore, but he was a great trumpet player. And so he started doing horn dates for different small album projects, and then all of a sudden one day we were recording for Quincy Jones for Michael Jackson. And
yeah, there's this Thriller album a few people
heard.
Well,
that was the first one, I don't think.
Off the Wall?
Off the Wall, yeah. Maybe. Yeah, I can't remember which one of them came first, but
that's so crazy.
I'm going to play with this guy, Michael Jackson.
And so that was sort of like putting, my career went into kind of overdrive at that point. You know, because it was sort of visible amongst the musicians in town. And plus, I was playing on Toshiko Akiyoshi's big band, and we were playing around town some. And so there was different ways of, I mean, it's like networking in a way. You get seen, and you people, you know, they hear you, and they figure that you can handle the job, you know. So I started doing some studio work, you know, at Universal, and I did a little orchestrating for a show called Rich Man, Poor Man that nobody... Oh, you... Yes, I can see a couple of... not... Yeah, yeah, me too.
Wake them up and they'll remember it.
Yeah. And but it just kind of started. It was like, you know, opening up a business and it gradually grows.
Like an unravels kind of thing.
Yeah,
That's amazing. And so if I can briefly brag on you, I opened your IMDb page... And I was just laughing all morning. So, well, you just did the new Indiana Jones movie.
I told you
trombone
was funny.
Yeah, that's true. You did.
It's very funny. And I can't. The two most recent Star Wars, Mandalorian, The Lion King, which I know every word to every song. Don't test me.
I've heard him sing it all. So yes,
I'm not embarrassed. Not embarrassed.
Me too.
Both Lion Kings.
Both Lion Kings. Aladdin, yeah. An amazing soundtrack.
Yeah.
Golly, here we go.
Oh my God,
Predator. Yeah. I was telling Nick today that I thought the entire Predator soundtrack is just the.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
But I was like, is there trombone on that?
There is trombone in there a little bit. Yeah.
Golly, Moana. I can keep going. Ghostbusters, The Jungle Book, Deadpool, Star Wars again. Jurassic Park.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Frozen. Yeah, I mean, you can't name one. You can't name one that you guys haven't played on, I feel like. So is it a type of thing where sometimes you just, it's just such a part of your day, you're like, oh, did I play on that? Like,
oh, yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to remember.
I write down the titles, but if I don't have the list in front of me, I don't.
What a nice problem to have.
I mean, it's just a list, you know. It's just anything else, you know. Some of those names that you just mentioned, one, I forgot about that one. There's a few of them that slipped from your mind.
Are there any real big ones that you recorded on, but you just never saw it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I did see the last Indiana Jones movie. They showed it to the orchestra. Out there, and
the one that just came out.
The one that just came out.
Yeah,
I did the last couple of those, okay. And it was fun because they had we did like a little surprise event. They had Spielberg and George Lucas and the director of the movie, and they had an audience at the Kodak Theater in Hollywood, and they had a full orchestra conducted by John Williams on stage with the curtain down, and the audience didn't know we were there, so we had to be real quiet, and they. They said, oh, we were just like telling, oh, there's one other person that we haven't introduced yet who we couldn't have done this without. And they raised the curtain, and there's John with the orchestra. And we played these three tunes, and then they brought the thing back down, and we went across the street to the El Capitan Theater, and they showed it to us, just the orchestra, which is cool because anytime there's a little solo, the orchestra erupts in applause. Like, you don't get that in a regular movie theater, yeah. But, you know.
Have you ever watched a movie and you hear something and you're like, that sounds familiar. I think I played that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now, especially if it's movies back going to the 80s or, you know, it's like, maybe because I don't remember some of the titles without looking on the list, like you say. But, yeah, there are things that do, you know, to jog my memory a little bit.
Bill, I wanted to ask you a question. I've heard recordings of you playing tenor.
And oh, yeah.
Going back to, you know, you two meeting, were you playing tenor in the section or bass?
No, I was playing bass.
So you were primarily a bass trombone player at this point?
Yeah,
okay.
Always primarily a bass trombone player. But when I got to L.A. and started doing the record dates, were you had to play tenor trombone.
Sure,
so that's all that Jerry Hay stuff was tenor trombone.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is I've heard you play tenor in really be playing tenor, not just doubling on it, but sounding phenomenal, taking solos.
Well, I'm always hoping stuff. I'm really playing it.
Yeah. I mean, you know what I mean. Like, no, the difference between doubling and really.
I appreciate
really,
what you're saying. Yeah. I always feel like that's my weak double, and that's mainly what I'm playing right now around Asheville. There's no call for bass trombone in anything that I've done. I haven't played bass trombone in Asheville yet.
Wow.
I've been playing tuba and tenor trombone, like Dixieland and stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
You're
though.
Starting over on the East Coast.
Yeah, starting over, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Just like hand them your resume. I've done a couple things.
No, the resume doesn't cut it, you know.
So I'm curious about, you know, the week-to-week, day-to-day, and I'm sure your schedules will vary. But when you're in the heat of recording things, I mean, I'm sure there was some consistent things you had, but how last minute could some of these calls be?
Things like jingles would be extremely last minute. And sometimes, you know, you think, okay, it's an hour call. It turns out to be this thing that becomes a national spot. And you just showed up with, you know, a couple hours notice, and you made a lot of money over time with it. And the other thing is once they started having a union contract for demos for jingles, then you would get every idea they had, they would make a demo. So you get a last-minute call to do a demo, then come back the next day and the next day. And it was always last-minute because they're not sure yet what they want. So there's a lot of that. Same thing with movies and TV shows because maybe they didn't finish, like on a movie. They ran out of time. They got a call back. So we get a lot of those added days to things that are really last-minute.
And you just have to be available.
Or you have to be able to say no. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's a day notice, or sometimes it's a few hours notice.
Yeah.
And how often are studios conflicting against each other when they're trying to record?
Oh,
quite a bit.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, and Tommy Johnson, you know, the fabulous tuba player, he said, you're either in the business or you're not. He's talking about being available and showing up when you get called. Because he, like anybody, he was in constant demand, and he was getting all kinds of last-minute calls, but he was always there.
Will it be a thing where often you'll finish a four-hour session and then just sprint to the other one and knock that out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably less so now. I mean, the business from the top down, meaning the corporate top down, has changed. You know, the streaming content is a little bit different. The union contracts are a little bit different on that. But the business has been condensing it gradually over the years. Like, when I first started working in the studios, the guys that were busy, like Dick Nash and Joe Howard and Lloyd Ulyate George Roberts and all those guys, they would work like a double, meaning 2-3 hour sessions with a lunch break during the day, and then they'd go do a film date at night or a record date at night. They would do that day in and day out.
Yeah.
And then it started to get smaller. And so, there certainly were days like that, but there weren't as many days like that.
But that's how I got in. I know, because I wasn't the first call. But guys that you just mentioned, Dick, Lloyd, maybe Lou, or they weren't available. So then they got to me, and there was enough going on that, luckily, being in that position, I was getting these calls. So I ended up doing 2 or 3 things a week almost immediately because things were so busy. I'm talking about late 70s. Things changed a lot in time, but that's how that worked.
I remember subbing on something once for Slide Hyde, Dick Hyde. It was a very busy studio player when I got out there. And he called me to sub for him on a religious date over at that studio in the hills of Burbank. Remember that?
You're talking about Whitney?
Maybe. It might have been Leonard's? Whitney.
Yeah.
And I remember going in there and setting up in the room, and the contractor, who I had never met, walks in and he says, "Oh, I see we have some surprises today."
Wow.
Whoops. I said, "Well, I can go home right now if you want." And he said, "No, that's okay. Stay there." You know, and then Slide showed up, you know, an hour or two later, you know.
I imagine being people that work consistently on a strict recording schedule, I mean, you have to be experts at least trying to navigate L.A. traffic. I mean, that's got to be such
trying
an added stress.
Trying is a good word, yeah.
It's amazing. There was a book that came out long before GPS and traffic, long before all this. There was a book that these guys wrote called L.A. Shortcuts.
Oh, wow.
And that became my Bible. Because it was all these, you know, Waze takes it this way all the time now, but this was way back. And it was unbelievable, the different canyon routes to get from the valley to the L.A. and Hollywood side. But unfortunately, too many people bought that book, and then it was no longer an advantage.
Well, there used to be a map book that you'd buy when you first, the Thomas Brothers map book. It was like this thick. It was the map of L.A.
Yeah.
You know, and you could be on page 64, and it would go off the page, and then it would go to page 128. Or something like that, and you—that would be how you'd, if you were new in town. That's the only way you'd figure out your way to get around. You know, it's hard to do that while you're driving, but luckily there was no accidents at the time. But
and I mastered sometimes having to get to gigs like tuxedo jobs after working in the studios and going over to. I mastered the art of putting my tux on while driving.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Now
that's impressive.
Were you tying the bow tie too?
No, clip on. On. No.
I guess you can only go do so much while driving.
Yeah, I'm not a real tux wearer, apparently.
My motto is try not to take tuxedo jobs.
Don't tour. Don't take tuxedo jobs.
Well, you know, I figured out that doing the Academy Awards a couple of times, the most important part of it was having the right tux. Because more than playing. I mean, you could go in there and play wrong notes. But if you showed up wearing like a red plaid tux, they'd slow everything down until you changed. There wouldn't be anybody playing any notes until you got into the right color clothes.
So what percentage of these recording gigs would you say were sight reading?
All of them.
Just about all of them, yeah. I mean, sometimes they send out, now they send out music, maybe like John Williams music. But that's still, trombone parts are not as hard as string parts. They and the woodwind players, they have to look at those parts. They're playing thousands of notes. That's a bad per note ratio for the money.
Oh man,
dollar per note.
They chose poorly.
When they send the John Williams music out to you, is it like a guy with like handcuffs to a suitcase and he like gives you like 10 minutes to look at it?
Well, we get everything on Dropbox now. I'm living in the past. Yeah, we're getting Dropbox files for most of our stuff now in advance. So yeah, it does take the sport out of it. I used to love it though when we would just show up, and a lot of times they're still copying music, so you'd even don't get a chance to look it over earlier in the date. It just comes out. Oh, that's a fine. Yeah, how do you do?
They pass it out.
All of a sudden, the 16th notes and the ledger lines. Oh, thank you.
Turning it upside down, seeing which way it goes.
Yeah, and thanks for doing that on the sixth hour.
Yeah.
And what's the expectation? You show up, you sit down, you probably start noodling through your part as quickly as possible. And are they expecting you to just be ready to go first take? And sometimes that's your only take, kind of thing, or.
Oh, it's not usually one take, but my feeling about it is to try to make it like it's going to be one take. And depending on what the music is, it could be the second take. I mean, Walter Murphy.
Walter Murphy,
Family Guy, we both do that. And that's frequently a quick run through, and then you start to
Family
make,
Guy?
Okay. You start to make takes, and usually one take is enough unless something catastrophic happens.
Wait, that just reminds me. Did both of you play on Lost?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So we were the
no.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
awesome.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That was everything. That was every major dramatic transition.
Yeah.
It's,
Michael Giacchino. We do all Michael and Alex Iles too.
Stuff.
And Alex Iles. Whenever the three of us are on gig, we'll sometimes go into that Lost thing just because we can.
It's perfect for that show. I don't know if you guys watched it, but it really was effective. Super.
Was it always the same interval, but on the gliss? Between the parts, because I can hear it in my head right now.
I don't think so.
I think it was kind of like whatever note you wanted to play.
Really?
I think. Right?
It's just dramatic.
I thought we had starting notes, but I'm not sure.
I don't remember.
Senility is sitting in. Forgive me.
You guys were, I think you did it once on like as a kind of a gag on like Letterman or the Tonight Show.
It was the Kimmel Show.
Kimmel Show.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. After the show ended, they had the cast on and they had some of us from the orchestra to play with their band.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's when I was like, my God, it's them. I know them.
It was great.
That's so cool. Oh, man. I could geek out about so many random things that you guys have done, but we need like 5 hours.
Yeah. I have a deep dive for you, Bill.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm going to surprise you on this one. So I have a big curiosity for random facts and random knowledge. It's kind of what gets me going. I love that stuff. So I like watching documentaries. One night I'm sitting on the couch with my wife and there's a new documentary out on Netflix about people who love fruit. Do you know where I'm going with this?
No.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Okay. And I'm watching it and it's like people who are into fruit, I guess. And there's a video of you sitting there. Do you not remember this?
No.
Did you go to like a random meeting someday? There was a camera there.
You even, because I said, that looks like Bill Reichenbach. And the next scene is you conducting a trombone choir. And you introduce yourself.
Oh, geez. What? I can't even imagine what that is.
Do you like fruit?
I do.
Well, you're on a documentary about people who really like fruit.
Wow.
Nick was so excited to tell you this story. And you're like, is that me?
That's amazing.
It's called Fruit Hunters.
Fruit Hunters.
Good night, everybody.
I have a new idea for our podcast. Every podcast, we interview someone and we just like make up a documentary that we saw them on.
That's a different food group each time. Yeah. Wow.
Oh my God. That's hilarious.
Send me the link to that. I'd be curious. Yeah.
Because I said to my father, that looks like a freelance trombone player in LA. And it cut to you and you introduced yourself. So I was like, it is.
Is it by any chance a neighborhood thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, there was different aspects. Like there's different like acts in the documentary. And there's people who like traveled the world searching for fruit. And then they went to LA. And this neighborhood one was run by
Bill Pullman.
Bill Pullman.
The actor. Okay. So now,
we're back.
I don't know that I've seen it, but I'm aware of something like that. When I lived in the Hollywood Hills, Bill Pullman and his family have a house. It's like a little bit down the hill from where I lived. And several years we played our little Christmas concert in the cul-de-sac in front of his house. So that's what that was.
Yeah. And so you were in this meeting, though. That's how I saw you first.
Well, I think I might have gone. They started an orchard up there.
Yes,
on the hillside behind his house. He owns a big piece of property there. It's like, apparently it's one of the original possible sites of the Hollywood Bowl.
Wow, oh, that's cool.
And they chose otherwise, obviously, but and so that's what they have there. Yeah,
that's the most LA sounding thing. Like, I just started an orchard in my backyard. You guys should come over.
Well, yeah, so I was trying to have like a just kind of decompressing night away from music, away from the trombone, and get pulled right back in by a fruit documentary.
Sorry about that. Yeah, but the Christmas carols were okay.
You know? Yeah.
Okay, a few more topical recording questions, if you'll humor me. Will you always bring multiple horns to a gig just to be prepared?
Always.
Like, how many would you normally bring? Or you just load up the trunk?
Well, it depends on what your primary call is. You know, I imagine if you're a tenor trombone player, you'll probably bring a bass trombone, too. If you're a bass trombone player, nowadays, you probably bring a contra.
That's so many, right?
Sold quite a few contras.
And you probably bring your tenor with you most of the time.
Yeah, right? I mean, I do have out in L.A. now, the horn that I have out in L.A. is a double case with a tenor and a bass in it. But if it's a bass trombone call, I'll always bring the contra.
I heard someone told me that at least some of the studios have like shopping carts so that you can load all your gear in.
No.
We bring our own carts.
Yeah, you bring your own carts.
Yeah, we have,
but they're not shopping carts.
We have folding. Like, they fold flat in the trunk of the car.
Yeah,
like I
see.
So okay. The trunk of my car has to be big enough. I generally bring in tenors, but I kind of have three tenors because I have the small bore, the large bore, which we're using more and more in the film and TV, and also a medium bore slide to go with that. So it's three slides and two bells and a bass trombone. That and two mute bags because the bass trombone mutes take up so much room. So that's my usual, and on occasion, contra will rear its ugly head, or even tuba at times.
And that's kind
or
of
tuba,
a,
yeah.
Like a strategy now. Like if you can convince the composer to like add more doublings, that's a nice.
It's always something that we try.
It's encouraged.
This really needs alto trombone.
The union. Well, it never needs alto
not
trombone.
Alto. Yeah. Wrong.
I did one record date on alto trombone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, you know, it's just kind of an interesting aside. You know, I have students that will talk about starting to double, and those from tenor trombone, they'll be like, oh, I should learn how to play alto. Sure, of course, but the marketability of the alto trombone is so narrow compared to, like, if you're a tenor trombone player, you really should learn how to play bass. And if you're a bass trombone player, you should learn how to play tuba.
That's true.
You know, it's like those are the more... It's like in New York, it's the Broadway scene. It's the double.
Right.
Some recording, but very little. And in L.A., of course, it's the studio scene. But, I mean, you just said you had one date on alto, right?
Yeah, I think that's one. I think one.
And
yeah.
I've never had any date on alto.
So if anyone's thinking about, I mean, I'm not discouraging alto out of the gate, but just think about that. Like, you know, these are people that have played everything. And how many alto gigs? Basically goose egg.
I had one date on alto valve trombone too, which I have an alto valve trombone. Yeah.
How much dust is on that right now?
Oh, no, I like that horn. It's an old con from the 1870s.
Wow. No kidding.
Next time you have a chance, go to Bill's website and look at his room of instruments
my
that you've collected.
Room, yeah.
Your former room.
Yeah.
How many instruments have you collected?
I don't know, maybe 80 or something like that. Cornets and trumpets and trombones.
Amazing.
And
if we got you and Doug Joe and Dave Taylor together, who would have the most trombones?
Oh, that's a good
question. Dave would just have a lot of parts.
Good question.
Yeah.
Doug has all the
Yeah, I saw Dave too. Last week. He was in North Carolina.
Awesome.
And he had a couple of horns all
What mouthpiece is that?
All in pieces.
Sounds like Kenny Schwartz.
Yeah. Some kind of a plastic fiber bell, and he says, "Yeah, I'm going to play this on a couple of tunes."
He's been doing that more,
yeah,
because it's shoulder stuff, I think. Yeah.
Oh, could be. Yeah.
I have a question about something that you two probably know more about than most anyone, and playing into a microphone, which is, you know, the majority of trombonists train acoustically about filling into a big room. What are your general strategies playing into a microphone? Do you change your playing when you're playing into a microphone versus playing in a big room?
You know, things, if I may, things really have evolved in that case, because we used to, in the studios, play fairly close mic'd most of the time. And back then, most of the tenor trombone players were playing small bore instruments because they recorded sounding big.
Yeah, and it's easier on your end. Yeah.
And it's easier.
Compact sound.
And also musically, yeah. Back then, you know, the music was more of that period. Even stuff that sounded pretty classical was still being played on the small horns. And recent times, with the movies, they started using the microphones overhead above the conductor, and they call it a big tree of mics.
Right, yeah.
And the small horns started sounding a little edgy when that was what the bulk of the recording was coming from, and we all gradually got into bigger horns. So we're mostly all playing symphonic-sized trombones now for those kind of studios, but every so it depends on the session. If you go in, you're doing a record date or you're doing a jingle and close mic'd, so it's not so much that we play different as much we'll play the different equipment.
Right, okay.
But a close mic, how are you? Are you aiming right into it? Or are you a little offset?
Well, for my own projects, yes. I actually changed the axis because I've done these multi-track projects, and to get it away from that phase sound, I will change the axis quite a bit. I've also changed horns from part to part to have a little different sound. As far as that work, I kind of leave that up to the engineer, where they want to play.
And you're really at the mercy of the engineer. You know, there's good engineers and there's bad engineers. And they can make you sound terrible or they can make you sound great. And it's just the way they hear it. The microphones that they use, the microphones vary a lot. And
do you have favorite microphones?
Well, I like the old RCA mics a lot.
I have two of those.
Ooh.
Yeah, I have one of them, and I have an AEA who makes new versions of the old RCA.
Those ribbons?
Yeah, they're great ribbon mics. The AEAs are the best now, available to buy. Yeah, because you can't find RCAs.
No, I was lucky to get the one I got in New Zealand. I looked in this big cabinet at this recording session that I was doing down there with my friend Roger Fox, and it was like the broadcast house in Wellington, and they had like a display of all these old mics. They weren't using any of those. They were using new British mics. And I said, well, what did you guys do with all those old RCA mics? Oh, we just got them sitting around here. So the next time I went down there, the guy gave me one of them.
Wow.
Gave?
Whoa.
Yeah, that's...
They're not cheap.
No.
If you can find them, like you said.
So
I'm just saying, it's ancient technology, and they're still, if not the best trombone mic, they're pretty close to the best.
So there's not one hard and fast rule about what you typically... If you have a microphone right in front of you, where you're going to aim and how... Just kind
not
of,
at work. Like I said, on my projects, yes, you know.
But they kind of just will adjust it and you don't touch it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we have people complain sometimes to the engineer, I play down here. They don't want to hear about that. They'll say, you play, I'll hang the mics.
Mm. I mean, they've tried stuff over the years, like they've recorded, you see pictures of sessions, especially in New York, where they would have the trombone section sitting all facing one mic in the center of them. So they're sitting kind of like a closed four, all pointing toward the center, and they record it that way.
Hmm. We did that way at Capitol and TTG for a long time.
Yeah.
Playing into a 44 from both sides.
And would this be just like a trombone session? Like
no, they would have the trumpets sitting over across the room.
So brass
doing the same thing in a circle.
It would be like three saxes, trombones, trumpets all in the room separate.
Playing in a circle is kind of cool for hearing each other. I always liked that.
Yeah, so did I.
We never do it anymore.
I mean, that's a fun way to play chamber music in general, you know?
Right, yeah. Right. I don't know why that's gone away. You can't see a conductor.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, which is the reason why we should do it again. I'm just going to leave that right there.
I mean, you'll both know what I'm talking about because I do some sessions out in New York. Almost all the time, the conductor cannot conduct even with a click track. So you're looking up and you're like, everyone has the click in their ear and they're somehow phased off from, it's like, how is that possible? Just conduct with it, you know? And then they're saying, well, play with the click. You got to play with the click. It's like, okay.
For the most part, it's a good idea to try not to look at them and not don't let them throw you off.
Well, do you know the acronym LUFU? I won't say the look up, up.
Fudge up.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
oh, yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, your wife's a conductor.
I used to have a stamp that I made of, you know, eyeglasses for watch. I had a circle and a slash around eyeglasses. So I'd stamp part. Don't look up.
Don't here. Look.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal that one. That's important.
Yeah. You got it.
Okay. Well, we have a bunch of questions from the audience, and we always finish with like a rapid fire quick question thing. So let me get to some of these questions from the audience. I'm sorry, I won't be able to get to everything. I'm just going to say boo to the person who asked about their favorite mouthpiece. It's that joke. We don't do that here. Okay, let's see. Bill, where did your time with Chuck Mangione and Bill Evans fit into your life?
Bill Evans? No, I'm not quite sure how that fits in. Chuck Mangione started to do those big orchestra concerts while I was still a student, and I was playing in the jazz ensemble that he was conducting. So I just got placed in that situation for all of those, you know, Friends in Love and those different concerts that he did with the Rochester Philharmonic.
Cool.
Bill Evans. That's a that connection, huh? On a Bill Evans album? I don't remember doing an album with Bill. Yeah.
How lucky to be able to possibly forget playing with Bill Evans. Evans.
I don't. I wish I had.
There were substances back in the 70s. Where I'm just going.
That's true.
Go on.
It was reasons to forget.
Here's just a general question. What's the most fun thing about playing in the studio?
The camaraderie, I got to say. You know, because we play music, we want to play good music. That goes without saying. But, you know, Lloyd Oliate said, I never worked a day in my life. And I know what he meant, because it's always fun. In fact, the worse the music, sometimes the more fun we have, because we're trying to maintain our sanity. No, it's special. It is our social life. It really is a fantastic camaraderie. You know, that we have, especially trombone sections, I think more so than some of the other sections.
Oh, yeah, we're the best.
You guys know about it.
Yeah,
and
you
the
know,
music is always new.
Yeah.
So you're playing fresh music every time you go in there.
Yeah. And I heard a story, I can't remember who it was, they were talking about how this really resonated with me, I'm sure it will resonate with you as well. They were talking about, they you know, got so busy, and they're busy and busy, and then they're, you know, playing in Carnegie Hall or something like that, and there's this moment of just like, I've made it, like, you know, and how lucky am I to be doing this? And, you know, I think anyone's lucky. We're all here doing this. Silly. It's silly what we're doing. Yeah. But we're just so lucky, you know, and you guys are at the top of that lucky heap, you know.
Well.
Luck isn't just blind, of course.
Well, you know? Who knows?
Yeah. No, it's been really thrilling. I mean,
of course,
first time you get to work for a master like Jerry Goldsmith, Elmer Bernstein, John Williams. It's hard to describe that thrill.
Yeah.
It really is.
Well, especially now getting a, like you said, Sebastian, getting a John Williams score right now. I mean, it could, you know, he's not getting any younger. No. It could be the last one, you know?
Very likely.
The unbelievable, you know, to be alive at a time that you get to do that, that's incredible.
Have you ever had sessions where you were talking about sometimes the music's like, what's going on here? Have you ever had a session where you're playing something and you're like, what is this? And then it turns out to be like an incredibly famous thing.
Oh, yeah. And I won't name the movie.
I'll ask you privately.
Yeah, that's a few times.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's no accounting for that. It's never going to be up to us. You know, whatever we think is good is probably a death knell for it.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of that going around these days. That's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah, that's your. Yeah, that's good. You're still working out there, and I.
Well, I like. Oh, go on.
I was gonna ask one of the questions from the Whova app. Many of the top studio trombonists like yourself seem to also be great jazz players. Do you think this is because the skill set for both is very similar?
That's a good question. I just think being a jazz player, you have to really have mastery of your instrument. And I think jazz players are listening. And I think sometimes there are players who don't play jazz who don't get used to listening to others while they're playing. They fixate on what they're doing. You know, I think that might be part of the answer to that question. What do you think?
Alan will be happy to continue that conversation out in the hall with any of you that... No, I'm just kidding. No. I do think it might be an issue of flexibility. And there certainly are jazz players who are very out of place in the studio business because Absolutely. they do that and they don't think about what has to happen in the studio business. So I think that idea might have been more the case 20 years ago than it is now. I think there's a lot more symphonic type players in the studios than there was back then. You know.
Yeah, quite a bit more, and they're very flexible and very versatile.
And I mean I mean the film studio business. The film studio business has gotten more orchestral in the last since all the John Williams kind of changed all of that. He created an opening for a lot more musicians to work at once.
Are you warming up a little different on a day where you know you're going to go play a John Williams score?
Well, I certainly want to make sure all the notes play. Yeah.
Turn the trombone on.
Yeah, turn it on. Make sure it's running.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Okay, maybe some more quick questions. So we have about 20 minutes. A question we asked to everyone. Advice to your 18-year-old self.
Advice to my 18-year-old self. Let's see. Well, I don't know. I mean, I love doing everything I was doing then, and it just progressed. And I wouldn't change any of it, actually, to tell you the truth. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. I kind of made my decision what I wanted to do with my life at that point, was heading straight for it. So, you know, maybe I would have wanted to take up more instruments sooner. I didn't get into my doubling until a couple years after that. So it might have been nice to start then, but that wasn't on the radar then.
That was the kindest advice to your 18-year-old self we've ever had on this. Usually it's like, stop partying so much. Yeah. Go practice.
Oh, well, I wasn't partying that much. Something to keep in mind, and I wanted to mention this during the course of this, is that if you should join the musicians' union, because the musicians' union has contracts that pay residuals and they pay pension, and if you have a whole career that doesn't involve union contract work, by the time you get my age, you won't have a pension to fall back on, because you wouldn't have been putting any money away probably for that, unless you're good at that kind of thing. I'm not.
Yeah, so the union pension it could be a whole interview in and of itself. Talking about
yeah. That. Matter of fact, I did a whole thing at one time at one place down in North Texas with John Swallow. He and I sat and talked about the union in the union for an hour. And I still believe that.
Yeah, it's interesting, just kind of going down that road for really quick. There's more and more non-union gigs, and then it becomes self-fulfilling to do non-union gigs for some people. But then it also becomes self-fulfilling for the union to become weaker, and that's a problem.
Non-union gigs are kind of like a 1700s musician model, where you go play the job, you get paid, and that's it. And if you want to have the modern model is having a contract that has attachments to it, like we have a thing called the secondary markets fund. When you play on a film and that film goes to TV, or they're still trying to figure out how to do it for the new streaming and everything, but there's another payment involved there that just shows up. You get a check in the summer, and the check, depending on how much of this kind of stuff you've been doing, I mean, that check for me is bigger than the money I ever make during the year playing, because of all the secondary markets, the way the music has gone from one thing to another, and it just happens without you knowing that. And that'll continue going on, you know. So you want to be connected to that when you're playing. Every time you play, you want to be connected to that kind of thing if you can.
I hate when that happens, when all these random checks just show up. And, what
yeah,
is this?
Really.
Yeah. Yeah. What a waste of paper.
God, you made me walk to the mailbox again. Just trying to have a nice day. Can you pick, this is an impossible question, but is there one recording that's just the most memorable that just really sticks out that you're really, really proud of?
Well, I'll say this, my favorite movie score that I played on, because there have been so many great things, but of the movie scores I've played on, I have to say Silverado is my number one favorite.
Wow.
It was just so special. And I remember talking, the engineer was a guy named Armin Steiner.
Oh,
who
Armin,
was one of the true greats. And it was at Fox, which that room he practically built. And he said it was the most satisfying project he had ever worked on. And he worked for everybody, John Williams. Armin Steiner was one of the, it was just thrilling. It was just thrilling. And not too many baffles in the room. Percussion was right to the side. French horns were next to us. If you hear the score, you just realize you're hearing it all together. There was no piecemeal.
And that's rare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, back in 1985, it wasn't quite as rare.
Yeah, now it is. It's very rare.
That's before Pro Tools. Yeah. But they did do pickups and punches before, but that one was pretty much solid. Fantastic.
What about you, Bill?
Well, first of all, I have to agree with Al, but I didn't play on that score. It's still one of my favorite scores. I would have to say probably the recent John Williams things are some of the best things I've ever played on. And the various projects with Jerry Hay and the horn section, it's like one, it's like over here and then over here, complete different kind of business, you know.
Cool. What's the most, this it might be Silverado, but what do you think the most underrated recording that you've ever made is, that you thought was awesome that just not a lot of people knew about?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
That takes some thought.
Yeah.
What was that movie that Walter Murphy did?
We did two Ted movies. Are you talking about the Ted movie?
Something about the West.
A Million Ways to Die in the West. Yeah, we did that one.
That was a really great score. He writes so well. It's so playable. And I like that movie a lot. I don't know whether or not it was a hit movie of any kind.
I think it was kind of, it was built up to be something really big, and I think it didn't meet those expectations.
Yeah, it didn't.
It was the more quirky side of Seth MacFarlane, yeah.
Seth has always been so supportive of using live musicians.
He's our hero.
Yeah.
He always increases the size of the group every season, like Orville, which has some great writing going
on. Okay.
Joel McNeely, it started with Bruce Broughton, and then Joel McNeely's done a lot of them. A couple other people like John Debney, and he's saying, write music.
Yeah.
He is not getting in the way. Sometimes they have to do things to get out of the way of the dialogue. But as far as writing the music, he is like all for it.
Well, he's a great singer, too.
He's a terrific singer.
Yeah, he is.
An original score for every new Family Guy, every new. Yep. And did you do the Cosmos, too?
No, I didn't do that.
You did that one? Yeah. That was Sylvester, right? But there's like a new score for every Family Guy. Because they could just recycle material so easily.
You would think, but Walter keeps cranking it out. I mean, I don't know how many of these like six-bar bumpers he can crank out.
Yeah, they all have that certain Family Guy vibe to it, and he's definitely captured that.
Right?
Yeah, right. Exactly, yeah, exactly.
A thousand ways of playing that different.
Just a little bit different, so you have to practice it.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the most famous movie you've recorded for that you'd be embarrassed to tell people you never saw?
Oh, well, so many of the superhero movies.
Babylon.
Babylon?
See?
Babylon.
Maybe it's not.
Babylon.
Isn't that out? Yeah, I think it's out.
It's been out for a while. It's been out for a while.
I remembered that I played on it, so that was one that I was forgetting about. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which we won't get into. And so I think it's like a movie about the history of Hollywood, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a Damien Chazelle movie.
That's not too embarrassing.
I rarely go see the Marvel superhero type movies that I play on because they love big brass for those movies. So we make a good part of our living playing these comic book movies, but I have to say it's not my interest that much.
Do you guys have grandkids? Or I just not imagine yet. If you're around kids.
Oh no,
at
I
all,
do. Actually I do have a grandkid.
You do?
I do. He's only a year old, and I'm just kind of getting used to it.
Yeah, congratulations.
Oh, you barely notice him.
Well, we have pictures of him all over the house. I shouldn't have forgotten that. Yeah.
I just think you'd be the coolest person ever to, like, a young person be like, oh, that's me playing on Marvel. Yeah.
Well, when my kid was younger, I did take him to the Spider-Man movies, and you know, back then. But since he's grown up now,
he's over it.
Yeah. Well, I'm over.
Well, he was over it. You were
over
it all the
time. He doesn't live with me anymore, so he's on his own. Yeah. If he wants to go see him, that's fine.
And say, hey, great job, Dad.
I had to see them twice. I'd see him to make sure it was suitable for him, and then I'd take him to see it with me. So I've had my belly full.
Okay.
How would you define success?
Probably being comfortable with what you do, being happy with your life. I think those are the important things.
Lots of exotic fruit.
Lots of exotic fruit. You know, papaya's out of season, if you can, yeah.
There it is.
Probably.
I think the accomplishments is something to be proud of, but only if you did a job that you're proud of and other people recognize as being a good job. Because some people can get calls, but they're not necessarily doing a great job. To be respected by your peers and people in the know, I think, is a big measure of what I feel success is. You know, and doing what you love, honestly, you know. I think that's a big part of it. And then another thing that I'm most proud of, in both of our cases, is longevity. I mean, we've been around a long time, and
I'm still doing it.
I think, is a measure of success too.
I'd agree.
Taking care of yourself, staying in shape, on the horn, outside of work, all that stuff,
yeah. Or at least trying to.
At least trying to.
Yeah.
There's a billboard that the entire world can see, and you can write anything on it. What would you write?
Oh, come on.
Go, Bill.
This is a Bill question?
He's editing right now.
Oh, yeah.
He's editing.
I've already gone through a few things I can't say. Be true to yourself. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
You got one?
What
Bill said.
Yeah, I think that's my side.
Yep.
What Bill said.
Yep.
Yeah, that's it.
Any regrets?
I've had a few. No. sorry.
I can't think of any, really.
Well, I'm divorced twice, so that's a loaded question for me.
Oh, we're thinking about that kind of stuff. Oh, no, I'm not.
But no, if you're talking about career-wise, no.
Yeah.
That's good. Oh, I would kick myself if I didn't ask for just a little bit more about your memories from recording with Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson. Was Michael Jackson around?
Sometimes. He was very quiet. He would sit in the booth and not say anything. I actually conducted a string session for him one time because it would have been Jerry Hay usually, but he was out of town. So it got to me by default. Basically, I hadn't written the string chart until I showed up at the session, and the string players were all bustling around, and they played the track for me, and I had to write it in front of them, kind of, which was a little bit nerve-wracking. And then we got through it, and of course, then he made changes, and we came back and did a little bit more. And then he made more changes, and then by that time Jerry was back in town, and he came in and made some changes. So it was like, I can't even remember the name of it.
So Michael was always really involved in the process.
Well, it kind of in a quiet, way. You never saw him doing anything like that, but he had his opinions, and they would come up probably after you left. So, yeah, that's always, you know, some rock artists are always like the great unknown.
Is there any, before Nick's last question, is there anything that you'd love to say to our audience that we haven't talked about here? Anything else you'd like to say that we haven't covered, either of you?
Well, I'd like to say that it's a kind of business that you get into because you have to. You know, everybody knows how difficult it is to get into this kind of business. And I remember Bill Berry used to lead the high school all-star band at Monterey Jazz Festival, and he was asked, how many of these people will go on to be professionals? He says, the ones that have to. And I think that's what it is.
That's brilliant.
If this is what you have to do, follow your dream. Follow your dream. Nobody's going to hand it to you. You know, and just be like Bill was saying, be prepared to sleep on the street, be without food. When you know you have to do something, you're going to do that. You're going to do whatever it takes to make it. And there's always room. Even though people say how slow it is and changing, there's always room, you know.
When I moved to New York and was starting to really work there, there was a trumpet player who had been around for a long time, and he told me when he moved to town, they were like, oh, you missed it, kid. You know, 20 years ago, this was 1960s. Oh, 20 years ago, that's when it's really happening. And he said, you know, I've been working every day of my life since I got here. And so he said, if someone tells you that, just nod your head and just keep trucking, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
The business always looks worse than it used to. It just looks that way. But there are entry points which you have to kind of figure out. And so getting into the business because you have to is because you have to come in from the inside of where your feelings are. You know, you have to because you want to. And then you have to be patient, and you have to learn how to communicate with people in a way that doesn't offend the players that are already there. You know, that's one thing. You probably don't want to show up on a session and give the impression to the person you're sitting next to that you want all of his work or her work, you know. So, like, getting in there and doing that fantastic warm-up routine is probably better to do that at home, and to come in and play a couple of long tones and leave it at that and get ready to play, you know.
Yeah, like how much of the, and we got to close soon, but how much of the work would you say is not just from how good you guys sound, but the relationships you've built and the trust that you've built?
Tremendous amount.
A lot of it, yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of great players who didn't get that part of it, who came in and they were immediately going up to the leaders, handing them their CDs or offering them this favor or that favor. And it ruffled the feathers of the guys that helped them get there in the first place. And then, you know, if you don't have everybody else on your side, you're not going to last long.
And the leaders are not necessarily going to take that CD home and first thing they want to do is put it on the player and listen to it. They got other stuff to do. They probably got music to write for tomorrow.
Yeah. Someone told me this, the P's of being a musician: personality, politics, punctuality, and performance. And you got to have at least two of those. And if you have three or more, you're going to be sitting pretty.
Yeah, eventually.
Yeah, of course.
And paprika. No.
And well, papaya. Yeah.
There you go. Papaya. Yes.
Papaya.
You know, I always ask this question. What do you think young trombonists need to do more of, or aren't doing enough of, if you want to look at it?
Maybe listening to all different kinds of music. I mean, start with all the stuff that has trombone parts, but then there's a lot of other stuff that doesn't have trombone parts that's valuable to intake, you know, the kind of music, just to broaden your whole understanding of what music is about. You know, I like pre-Baroque music a lot. I've listened to a lot of that kind of stuff. I've played recorder a little bit over the years and stuff. I love that music. And I don't know whether that had anything to do with the way I play or anything. Probably not. But it did make me approach music from a different standpoint. And I think that anything that comes across to you, like, take it seriously, even if it's something on the radio in the car, like, don't let it go by without listening to it, if you have the concentration for that.
Yeah, and I would agree. And listening to a lot of people don't like to listen to what they consider old-fashioned, like trombone players from the 40s, 50s, 30s, whatever. And that's a wealth of information. And believe me, I'm speaking from experience, you need to be able to play like that at times. It really is something, it's a skill set you have to have. And I think I would encourage people to listen to as much of the history of the players as they can.
Just like the tune, I'm Old Fashioned.
That's
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
Well, I can't thank you guys enough for hanging out with us. It's been a real treat for me and Nick. We've been really excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, this was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Even though you destroyed my dreams as a 16-year-old, you know, it's good to come back and...
I think it worked out, Sebastian.
No, yeah. I mean, it was actually great advice. It was a very thoughtful answer, but... I can't thank you for your contributions to the trombone world, to the music world in general, and I hope you always look back at everything you've done and continue to do and be proud. And it's just wonderful.
That's remarkable.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. It's a pleasure. Thanks.